Good evening. We're on spyman.ca. Today is Saturday, March 31st, 2007, and welcome to our show, Exposed. We're very honored to have a roundtable talk tonight, a very exciting show, because we have a very special guest by the name of David Hawkins on, and Eric Hufschmid, who wrote Painful Questions, will be on as the second guest, and we'll both be asking David Hawkins questions. So good evening, David Hawkins. Welcome to our show.
Good evening, Ladybug and Eric. It's nice to be with you.
Now, we are going to ask these questions. You are a forensic economist. Exactly what is a forensic economist, and how did you get involved in the Citizens Association of Forensic Economists at Hawk's Cafe? That's your internet site, correct?
Yes, that's right. Well, I can answer the first question a little indirectly by telling you what I'm not. I'm not a forensic accountant, and a forensic accountant is someone who would normally be invited in to look at the books of a suspect company. And the kinds of frauds and violent crimes that I'm interested in, there are no books, because we're talking about organized crime and racketeering within largely opaque government departments and bureaucracies that don't normally show to the citizen which way the assets, including tax dollars, are going. So in respect of founding the Citizens Association of Forensic Economists at Hawk's Cafe, I founded that in around 2004 because I felt there was a need for mobilizing the ordinary citizen in a rather dramatic process that I now recognize is really exercising a right that goes back 1,000 years under English common law, which is the right of a grand jury to accuse no innocent but shelter no guilty. And what I've done is I've created an organization which now has 670 members, and if people go to the Hawk's Cafe website, they'll find they have an opportunity to subscribe, and it doesn't cost any money, to the Yahoo group. And if they go to the Yahoo group, they'll find, as I say, we have over 670 members around the world who are all categorized, at least in my mind and their mind, as members of the Citizen Association of Forensic Economists at Hawk's Cafe, collecting evidence against suspects for causing wrongful death. Now, we need to be very careful here. I'm not accusing anyone on this show or any other show of murder, simply because we know that murders have been committed, and in case of 911, 3,000 murders were committed, but they, technically, the perpetrators spoliated the evidence in the various scenes of crime to the point where it is not possible to get sufficient evidence in front of a jury to convict beyond reasonable doubt. A little like the OJ trial. OJ was ultimately taken in a civil claim for damages for wrongful death of Nicole Simpson, and the Simpson family won $30 million. Whether or not he paid, OJ paid, is almost irrelevant. So in the case of 911, what we're doing with the Citizens Association of Forensic Economists at Hawk's Cafe is we are acting as a virtual grand jury. That is, there's no physical evidence exchanging hands, but we now have a vast network of exceedingly talented individuals, some of whom were witnesses to the crimes of 911, who are sharing evidence and intelligence with each other across networks that range from face-to-face in a coffee bar, hence the Hawk's Cafe sitting on the coffee cup in at the website, to telephone conversations like we're having right now, to exchanges by email or the website. So effectively, we have structured ourselves in the same way as the enemy, because the enemy, that's begging the question who they are that put on the 911 attack, equipped themselves with what are technically known as virtual private networks to move Al-Qaeda assets around the world. Now, Osama bin Laden boasted shortly after 911 that he had three independent networks to move Al-Qaeda assets around the world, and all the resources of the British and the Americans couldn't stop him. And it was soon after that, it was published in the Time magazine article. I, as an engineer, and I've worked in many places in the world, including the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, and so on. I looked at this crime, and there was something that, there were many things that didn't gel. First of all, the impression that was intended to be communicated that a whole bunch of people in the Muslim world hate Americans and British and Australians and Canadians. And I'll tell you bluntly, that is absolute bullshit. I worked for 30 years internationally, but in particular 3 years in the Middle East and in Nigeria, which is a Christian, Muslim, and animist country. And never, ever was I treated with anything other than hospitality and respect. This entire notion that everyone hates America and Muslims in particular, and there's a sufficient support to actually kill 3,000 Americans, is a totally contrived spin by the media. It's intended, I think, to distract attention from a domestic attack that was orchestrated and engineered by a group of treasonous Americans and Canadians. So perhaps I should let you ask a question, if I...
Yes, I wanted to ask exactly who might these people be, and is the Mossad part of this network as well, because of the sightings of certain individuals making hoo-ha there at the 9/11 attack on the other side, on the Jersey side, and these people were arrested. Did you hear about that incident?
Yes, I did. And let me tell you, backing up to what a forensic economist does and doesn't do, we don't work by guilt by association. Because someone is doing something rather unusual, I, as a scientist and engineer, I don't infer from that that the behavior is anything other than suspicious and may need more explanation. I start from the principle that if a crime, a violent crime, has been committed, the first thing that one would normally do, and I'm not a policeman, etc., but is go to the scene of the crime and put a yellow ribbon around it, and no one, absolutely no one, crosses that barrier unless they have a reason to go in and investigate evidence, and they need very careful training not to, what is known as, spoliate the evidence. Now, in the case of 911, both at Debris Field in Shanksville, from Shanksville to New Baltimore, which is 8 miles long for United 93, the Pentagon Lawn and Ground Zero in Manhattan, all three scenes of crimes, in fact, scenes of arson, murder, and insurance fraud, were spoliated. That is, people were allowed in who shouldn't have gone in, and they took evidence away, Ladybug.
This was a systematic exfoliation of evidence, and were there any yellow strip lines set up, or why did they even not let the firefighters in? There was a lot of hullabaloo regarding the firefighters not allowed to get in to find their comrades.
Well, exactly. So there was no yellow tape put together. Now let me back up to these virtual private networks. The first significant virtual private network that was set up, in my opinion, to prepare a domestic attack on America from its domestic enemies and make it look like an Al-Qaeda attack from external enemies, was in 1993, when the Clinton administration was sworn in. And in March of 1993, Vice President Al Gore sat down with Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States, Webster Hubble, who was the Associate Attorney General, and a Rose Law Firm partner with Hillary Clinton, and Vincent Foster, who, as you know, died in 1993, and Joe Girouard. And they used funds stored by the U.S. Department of Justice that had been confiscated from the drug trade to buy in the complete production of AT&T's secure telephony system. And what that gave the insiders of the Gore-Clinton White House, let me put it another way. What that deprived Americans of is one citizen could call another citizen with this AT&T secure telephone system, and it was extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the CIA or the FBI to eavesdrop into that conversation. By buying up that entire production of the AT&T telephony systems, the secure telephony systems, what Gore and his friends were able to do is equip an insider group with the means to develop a conspiracy, such as the alleged attack of 1993 of the World Trade Center, and the one right through to 2001, when it actually succeeded in bringing the World Trade Center down, it allowed that group of insiders to develop their conspiracy undetected.
Well, is this an ongoing thing, or did it just start from the time of the technology of the AT&T, and who are the owners of AT&T? I noticed that some of the crime families were buying up the multiple shares of AT&T at a particular time. So you're saying that it was hatched in the 80s or 90s?
Well, it goes back further than that, but the technology of the virtual private network was introduced in the early 90s. Now, going back, in 1981, I was the coordinator of artificial intelligence and geoscience research for Schlumberger, which is a big oil field service company in Ridgefield in Connecticut. I left that company and I went to the United Kingdom, and I founded a company and developed many of the technologies needed for a virtual private network for the oil industry. In good faith. I mean, I never thought that one day those technologies would be used by organized crime. But going back even earlier than that, you could obviously imagine that people have used encryption systems for telephone conversation to scramble voice, probably back to the Second World War and possibly even before. So the idea of encrypting communications is, it may even go back to the Greek and the Roman times, when people shaved their heads and, you know, someone scratched a message on the top of a slave's head and then the hair was grown and the slave got through enemy lines, etc. But very interestingly, the idea of a murder-for-hire network, I believe, was set up in Arkansas, in the Arkansas correction systems, during the 70s. And the idea there was that a firm in Little Rock, Arkansas, called the Rose Law Firm, was actually used as a buffer to put together, knowingly or unknowingly, a murder-for-hire network where victims were injected with tainted blood mined from the Arkansas correction system. And this was what spread AIDS and hepatitis. And the victims that were receiving the tainted blood were actually had a life insurance taken out on them, so that when they died, the company that was buying life insurance in those people would make a huge profit. So the idea of a network of assassins to run a murder for hire service in the United States stretches back, I believe, to the Rose Law Firm and its clients and the various people who put the technologies together that would one day translate into a virtual private network to support a global murder for hire service as we saw in 911.
How diabolical. So who is part of this group in Arkansas that hatched it? Were the corrections people totally?
Well, if you think of it as a special weapon, you can see that there's an infinite number of ways of taking what would look like to be an innocuous object or material or composition or compound, such as blood, and turning it into a weapon by, for example, knowingly allow prisoners that haven't been screened for hepatitis or AIDS or whatever, who are frequently engaged in homosexual acts and spreading it, to give blood. And the Arkansas prison system, or Arkansas correction system, was set up as a private company to buy blood from the prisoners at $7 a pint and then market it amongst others through Canada through a company called Connaught in Montreal or Toronto at $50 a pint into recipients. And the extraordinary thing about that is, when you think about it, is if the recipient, and obviously they didn't back then, know that the blood that they were getting was tainted and would actually result in an early and quite possibly a very painful death, then the insurance company that is working with the Rose Law Firm could actually buy insurance on the victims without their knowledge and consent and collect the life insurance when they died. So So Roe's Law would appear to have been retained by international criminal groups to put together the development of special weapons and tactics that would support what is really a life insurance fraud. And the four partners at Roe's Law Firm, very interesting, Hillary Clinton, well, her name then was Hillary Rodham, was hired by the chairman of the Roe's Law Firm in 1976, and she was promoted to partner in specializing in intellectual property in 1978, in the same year when her husband, she got married that year, her husband, Bill Clinton, was elected the governor of Arkansas. And for the next, right through to 93, when this program stopped, the Arkansas prison system, with Bill Clinton as governor and Hillary Clinton as a partner at the Lowe's Law Firm, injected tens of thousands of Americans and Canadians with tainted blood.
So the idea is whoever they gave this tainted blood to, it would again domino who that they would have intercourse with, and they spread the disease that way, unbeknownst to them.
That's right, and by tracking the people and their contacts, including in the prison system, what was very interesting, and this is my allegation, is the Arkansas prison system provided the basis for a very sophisticated murder-for-hire network, where money was made through bogus life insurance contracts taken out on the victims. And the first weapon of the special weapons and tactic teams developed through the brokerage service of the Roe's Law Firm was tainted blood. And the partner at the Roe's Law Firm that was handling that particular set of contracts was Vincent Foster. And Vincent Foster is the man who died allegedly of suicide in 1993 in Washington, D.C.
So they must have got rid of him just so that he might talk of what transpired.
Well, the other partners of Roe's Law Firm are very interesting, because Hillary Clinton in 1986 to 1992 appears to have introduced what is called dead peasant life insurance to Walmart, but when she was appointed in the director. And a dead peasant life insurance is, as its name implies, is a company. When I was in the United Kingdom and started my software company, I had two senior software writers, and I took out quite lawfully what is called key man life insurance. I don't know if you've heard of that concept, but the idea was that my investors in my company invested a great deal on the ability of my team to write advanced software very quickly, and I had two outstanding individuals in that area, and if either of them or both of them had been killed, my investors' money would have gone down the tubes, because it would have been extremely difficult to replace those two individuals. So I took out Keyman Life Insurance with sufficient padding so that if one or both were killed, I could reasonably hope to recruit someone else, train them up, and get them back to speed. And it's a prudent thing, and it's something that is normally done with the full knowledge and consent of the investors in the company. Is that clear?
Yes, boy, this is
all right. If, however, like Walmart, when Hillary Clinton became a director in 1986 through to 1992, takes out life insurance not on its key executives, but the janitors, and the little people salting through the fruit, etc., etc., including even after they've left the company. The idea from Walmart's point of view is they can say to the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, when they come to collect a percentage of Walmart's profits, Walmart can say, well, we have what's called a contingent liability, because if our janitors and our people die, we have to pay out this life insurance. So we've taken the risk of, we've actually bought insurance on them, etc. So there's one method of actually called tax evasion, and another one is laundering money. Because you can launder money, dirty money, from the drug trade or whatever, through the dead peasant life insurance contract. So Hillary, it would appear, sponsored by a company called AXA, which is the world's largest life insurer, introduced dead peasant life insurance to Walmart. Now, in 1990, from 1990 to 1992, The United States, although it was a relatively minor supplier of weapons to Saddam Hussein, the one particular area that it focused on was cluster bomb technology, allegedly through a front company, Lafarge, the big cement company. And in the closing years of the Bush Senior administration, and if you recollect, Bush Senior had a background as a director of the CIA, it appeared to the CIA that there were a rogue group of business people inside the States and Canada that were supplying weapons of mass destruction, including, and in particular, anti-personnel cluster bombs, through to Saddam Hussein to kill large numbers of Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war. And there was a threat that that pipeline, that smuggling pipeline called Iraqgate, would be exposed. And it appears that Lafarge was the front for that pipeline, shipping the cluster bombs through Canada along the St. Lawrence Seaway in a partnership with Canada Steamship Lines over to Europe, where the equipment would be relabeled and then sent on to Iraq, to Saddam Hussein. Well, Lafarge, it would appear, felt threatened by the possible exposure of this pipeline, and it was called the Iraqgate scandal, and appointed Hillary Clinton as a director from 1990 to 1992, when, of course, she was a partner of the Rose Law Firm before becoming America's First Lady in 1993. So Vincent Foster handled the tainted blood brokering service for Rose Law Firm. Hillary Clinton appears to have handled the incendiary cluster bomb technology pipeline between the United States and Iraq. The man who hired Hillary Clinton, his name is Joe Girouard. In 1997, he became a director of, he was the chairman of Rose Law, he became a director of BEI Industries, that makes the missile gyroscope that allows, if it's configured into three axes, allows, if it's installed on a Boeing passenger plane, to fly the planes as they appear to have been flown on 911. And it's my allegation...
Remote control. What is exactly this gyroscope? Explain.
The gyroscope provides the position of the plane in space. It provides what's called an artificial horizon. So normally this gyroscope is called the QRS-11, the quartz rate sensor 11. It's a resonant system like a couple of tuning forks that are vibrating very quickly, and when it accelerates and spins, it sends a signal to the computer, and the computer can actually calculate the position in yaw and pitch and roll of the weapons platform. And normally this is a technology that goes into missiles, such as the Maverick missile made by Raytheon. Well, it appears that Boeing illegally modified at least 120 of its passenger aircraft. 20 flight boxes and 100 Boeing 737s, and shipped them to China, and an unknown number of modifications in the domestic United States and Canada. But if the flight box of these planes include this gyroscope with the appropriate remote controls, the planes can actually be hijacked, or hijacked electronically after they've been hijacked physically. So my colleague at Hortz Cafe, Captain Field McConnell, who's a retired Top Gun fighter pilot and a retired large passenger plane pilot, who probably knows more than anyone what fighter pilots and airline pilots can do and what they cannot do, he, at about the same time as I got very interested in 911, concluded that his friend, Captain Chick Burlingham, who was allegedly at the controls of Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon, and his hull, the plane itself, could not have flown in the manner that the weapons platform was flown to hit the Pentagon. And therefore, if the regular pilot couldn't fly like that, he was absolutely certain that the Muslim pilot, who allegedly couldn't even fly a Cessna or land it or take it off, he couldn't have done it, and therefore he didn't do it. So that weapons platform, whatever it was, and it's a side issue as to whether it was a 737, 7567, or a Global Hawk or whatever, that was flown by remote control because it moved across the Pentagon lawn over a grassy knoll at 540 miles an hour, and it took out a strategic target in the Pentagon, namely the U.S. Naval Command Center. And there is no way that Muslim hijackers with box cutters and a very preliminary training on a Cessna could ever have flown that weapons platform in that manner. Therefore, they didn't.
Why did they hit that particular site at the Pentagon? Was this a target?
Absolutely. It was a very strategic target, and the media has spun it with a few throwaway comments that it was an area under construction. Actually, it wasn't an area under construction. It had just been finished being constructed by a British company called AMEC, and I'll come back to AMEC. But what they were doing on the morning of 9/11, Canada and the NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, had launched a simulated attack in the war game of 9/11 called Global Guardian on NORAD, that's the North American Aerospace Defense, and the American Defenders. And I think we can prove at Horse Cafe that the organization that had written the script for that war game had actually been penetrated by the domestic enemies of the United States and Canada, and they'd rewritten the script. So the Red Attack Team, which was a simulated hijacking by Al-Qaeda, was actually flying, whether they knew it or not, is immaterial. They were flying decoys and drones that had been modified with this gyroscope. So towards the end of the war game, when, for example, the alleged flight A-77 got close to the Pentagon, normally the procedure is at the end of the war game, the Red Team commander, that's the attack team, gives an order to all the assets of the Red Team, knock it off. And that is, if the Red Team wins, it's within 3 minutes of target, or 25 miles if it's moving fast enough. And I believe what happened is the Red Team commander gave the command, knock it off, to the Red Team assets. The Blue Team in the Pentagon, for example, stood down because they thought, just like these war games take place twice a year, they thought the war game was over, and what would happen normally is the Red Team would go home, they'd have a beer, and they'd sit down with the Blue Team, and then they'd have what's called a debriefing or a lessons learned to establish where the weaknesses of the Blue Team were. However, the Red Team, and this is a group of Canadians, gave the command, knock it off. The Blue Team stood down, and then within that last 3 minutes, the controls of the weapons platform were switched from the Blue Team defenders, who thought they had the control of the decoys or drones, back to the Red Team attackers when the planes were steered remotely with the gyroscope on board to take out the strategic target of the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon.
So I've noticed that they do these training sessions called Atlantic Blue and various code names. These are the strategic maneuvers that they do at least once to twice a year, correct? And then this is...
Yes, and they're bogus. They're absolutely bogus. You see, there's one, and we warned NORAD last week, there was one that had United States Air Force and Canadian jet fighter interceptors diverted to the Yukon, miles away from anywhere, during a war game, when all the action, as we know, if it comes again, is going to be in the centers of population such as New York and Washington, D.C. Well, that's exactly what they did on 9/11. They diverted the Blue Team's assets miles away from Washington and New York. They had NATO AWACS, Airborne Warning and Command Systems, flying overhead with battlefield control, working for the Red Team side. And they'd sabotage the Blue Team defenders, effectively with an Al-Qaeda Trojan horse, so the Blue Team was tricked into standing down just when the Red Team simulation was switched from a Red Team simulation to a Red Team attack.
So this was coordinated such that it would happen exactly as they wanted. And how many people would have been involved with NORAD in this four games? Some new.
Yes, obviously, because you can have with these virtual private networks. There's a concept with a virtual private network called tunneling. So when Al Gore used drug money to buy in that AT&T telephone system, he actually inserted it into a number of government departments, including the Department of Justice and the Department of State and the Pentagon, etc. That was followed up with another technology produced by Nortel Networks called Voice over Internet Protocol, VOIP, and Nortel's technology was installed in the Pentagon. And then in 1999 to 2000, Motorola's Iridium satellite communication system was forced into bankruptcy by Manhattan Chase or J.P. Morgan, which is a Rockefeller and Kissinger conglomerate banker. And then a private equity group, which includes the Bin Laden family, bought through the liquidator the Boeing Iridium satellite communication system. So by the time of 9/11, Al-Qaeda, if one wants to call it that name, had backdoor access through virtual private networks to the communication systems in the Pentagon and the communication systems that controlled the illegally modified flight boxes of Boeing passenger aircraft. So they had the ability to stage a war game and at the last minute switch it from a simulated Al-Qaeda attack to a real one.
So this is rather interesting that the Osama bin Laden family got involved with Motorola to set up this Iridium satellite and launched a satellite into space. So very interesting when I noticed that you figured this out. So with the help of who did you have in the thought process of exactly what transpired that day on 9/11? There's a lot of intellectual professors or people that actually develop these systems. Where did you get the know-how behind
them? Well, that's my background. You see, I was coordinator of artificial intelligence and geoscience research. So I developed a worldwide electronic data handling networks with my company. And in fact, we solved data management problems in the oil industry. And data management, it's really very interesting. Everything is about data. You know, whether you're in the military or the oil industry, you need to know what's going on. So you have sensors which are sending you signals that can be jammed, they can be noisy, they can be very sparse in terms of the object. So I became a world authority in taking sparse and noisy data and using computers to build a validated interpretation of what was going on in the real world. I did that 25 years ago now. So when I saw this very sophisticated and coordinated attack, paradoxically I realized that someone had used many of the techniques that I developed, and it turns out that the number one suspect for me in terms of intellectual coordination of these war games has to be the disgraced and fired former CIA director John Deutsch, who was a professor or is a professor of chemistry at MIT. And in 1995 he was found to have taken 17,000 pages of top secret information from the CIA, and he was Clinton's appointee as director of the CIA. And he took 17,000 pages of top secret information from the CIA and put them on his home computer and shared them with parties unknown. I believe he shared them with the virtual private network that had been set up by Al Gore in 1993, using money confiscated from the drug trade.
Now, what is this Kyoto part, that part of the lawsuit that's pending? You call it the Arkanside and Kyoto 9/11?
Yeah, the name Arkanside, if you Google for Arkanside, it tracks back to a series of deaths, premature deaths of otherwise healthy people, and I guess Vincent Foster would be one, and former U.S. Commerce Secretary Ron Brown in 1976, whose plane crashed in Yugoslavia, and when the bodies came back, and again, it's very difficult to get cross-checked evidence, but it appears that the bodies came back with traces of thermite on them, which is indicative of a high-temperature accelerant used in the plane. What appears to have happened is that these virtual private networks that were financed with the drug money allowed, so to speak, a death warrant to be transmitted either by telephone in the case of AT&T, over the internet in the case of Nortel Networks Voice Internet Protocol, or through the satellite communication systems operated by Boeing. And the SWAT teams, Special Weapons and Tactic teams, could actually take out their targets around the world. So I think what we've done now, we've got a very nice, nice is perhaps the wrong word, but a very precise storyline where if you follow the money, you find it being laundered through the Department of Justice, which by the mid-90s had become totally corrupt, and used to buy virtual private networks to equip insiders of the Clinton-Gore White House, the Department of Justice, and the Department of State, and the Pentagon, with the technology they needed to for command, control, and communications, and intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance, C4ISR as it's called, that otherwise, that is the only really configuration of smart people that explains the particular events of 9-1-1 and also why the blue team defenders were tricked into standing down.
Now, how about the company Demolition Inc., and how does the Larry Silverstein fit into the two buildings being demolished precisely? There's also talk of just prior to this supposed drone or whatever hit the one of the towers, or both the towers, whatever they're alleging, because it could be all nothing but a hologram, could it have all been staged there with an attack, supposed, by a plane, but it was all set in motion with this company by the name of Demolition Inc., who took down the building?
No, it's not. Control Demolition didn't have the necessary reach to handle all the scenes of what essentially were murder, arson, and insurance fraud. There's only one company that was in all the key sites. It's a British company called AMEC. AMEC's major shareholder is Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs was led at the time by a guy called David Blood, who's now a partner of Al Gore in this Kyoto carbon offset company in Washington, D.C., called Generation Investments. Anyway, AMEC was doing, this is very important, and these are not David Hawkins' words or Hawks Cafe words, these are AMEC's own words. AMEC specializes in sabotage vulnerability testing. And sabotage vulnerability testing, AMEC was actually doing it in the Pentagon in Wedge 1 on the morning of 9/11. It was doing it in buildings or towers 1, 2, and 7 in Manhattan on the morning of 9/11. It was doing it in the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, which closed for 4 days. And it was doing it in the baggage screening area of Logan Airport. So AMEC was actually the only company with operations related to sabotage testing at all the key sites on 9/11. So it obviously has, it and its principals obviously have to be a key suspect. The other thing of interest is the company that got the contract to take the evidence away, technically that's called spoliating the evidence, was AMEC. And the first guy on the spot on 9/11 representing AMEC is an alleged associate of the Lucchese crime family. And apparently he was there to make sure that the organized crime and the labor unions cleaning up the site got along together. So the people...
I understand that the Bonanno family and the Vito Rizzuto crime clan is also part of this Lucchese group as well. So they probably got kickbacks in the cleanup of the site. Why haven't the authorities been pressing the issue, or are they hiding it? They're all part of it, the FBI and the CIA, with this monstrous act at 9/11.
Well, what you've got, you see, in classic racketeering terms, and the concept you may not have heard of, but labor racketeering, when organized crime gets inside a big labor union, it operates on a principle of fear and intimidation. And where they normally migrate towards is the big labor union pension funds and insurance funds. So in the days of Jimmy Hoffa Sr., when the Central States Teamsters Pension Fund was being raided by the mafia, what the mob found is that it didn't take a lot of effort to either bribe or frighten the trustees of the pension fund. And once you control the pension fund, you control the union. So, for example, if you look at the RCMP in Canada, you can see organized crime has got into controlling the RCMP pension funds. And apparently for years, senior officers in the RCMP have been complaining about graft and nepotism and bribes inside the pension fund, but it then becomes, after it's got past a certain stage, to all intents and purposes, organized crime control the pensions of the RCMP. In the case of British Columbia, for example, the Vancouver Police Department, where you know we've had this horrendous serial killer, or alleged serial killer, at the Picton Pig Farm, with maybe 100 women have been disappeared from the streets of Vancouver. It turns out the Vancouver Police Department Pension Fund is controlled by someone who's controlled by Teamsters Local 41 or 31, meaning the Teamsters. And of course that goes back to the Jimmy Hoffa tradition, and of course the modern president of the Teamsters is Jimmy Hoffa Jr. Effectively, one would have, unless the Teamsters has been really cleaned up, it would seem the Teamsters pension fund is controlled by organized crime, and organized crime now controls the Vancouver Police Department and quite possibly the RCMP pension fund. And that's how you get silence.
We've got the same problem right here in Ontario with the OPP being infiltrated. When you have a certain police officer suing former police chief Julian Fantino of taking bribes, we've got a problem throughout Canada. So this is just surfacing this week regarding the RCMP pension fund. It started being talked about approximately a year ago, but was hidden, and now the lower-ranking RCMP officials are talking about the cover-up coming from the top end. So I see.
It's huge. The Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, for example, OTPP, and OMERS for that matter, but OTPP. And over here we have the British Columbia Investment Management Corporation. Well, Ladybug, what we've got in BC, for example, we've got 4 million taxpayers and about 300,000 public servants or retired public servants. The taxpayers labor under $35 billion of provincial debt. The public servants sit underneath $76 billion of assets, which means the public service union controls the government of British Columbia. So you have these little people like Gordon Campbell who say we're going to do this and we're going to do this. His latest magnificent contribution to political governance in British Columbia is saying this province is going green. Well, let me explain to you how the green racketeering of Kyoto works. Al Gore, as you may know, he's just made a film and won an Oscar called An Inconvenient Truth.
It's being deluged around the world. I knew that.
Yes. And what we're being told is that if we continue doing what we're doing, the earth is going to warm up, the sea level is going to rise 10 feet, we're all going to die, etc., etc. And from the point of view, I won't even address the science because I'm a scientist. It's absolute rubbish. The intriguing thing is when someone tells you that they want you to pay them $50 a ton of carbon dioxide for the right to breathe out next year, you should always ask them, it's just like a snake oil salesman, you should always ask them, well, if I give you $50 to buy the right to produce carbon dioxide next year, what are you going to give me? Well, what they're going to give you, people like Al Gore and his partner David Blood, which are carbon dioxide trading brokers, they're going to give you an IOU, Ladybug. Meaning, the IOU is that next year, when you need to breathe out carbon dioxide, you have the right to breathe out. Right? But you should ask...
ransom.
Well, but what Al Gore then... What you should ask Al Gore is, well, Mr. Gore, what does it cost you to buy what you're selling to me? And the answer, of course, is it doesn't cost Al Gore and David Blood anything to buy a carbon dioxide credit and sell it on to me at $50 a ton, because they go to their nearest friendly bureaucrats with their big pension funds and say to them... And you might call it the Ministry of Environment or the Department of Environmental Affairs or whatever it was. The bureaucrats grant the broker the right to sell carbon dioxide forward at $50 a ton. So when they receive, Al Gore and his friends receive $50, they split it with the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats get a 50% kickback, $25, into their pension fund. And then $25 of the $50 is spent on something that gives lots of jobs to unionized public servants, like building windmills. So it's probably the greatest scam in the history of scams since the United Nations Oil for Food Program. And it's driven by a Canadian depopulationist who took a bribe from Saddam Hussein of $1 million by the name of Maurice Strong.
Maurice Strong, and now he's hightailed it to China. But
he's hiding out in China, but he's recently become the director of the Chicago Climate Exchange, Ladybug. So he's in a partnership with Al Gore, and they get kickbacks when the sheeple are stupid enough to pay him $50 a ton of carbon dioxide to save the planet. It's a scam.
It's a scam. So interesting that Maurice Strong, just when the heat got on him, regarding that oil for food scam, he hightailed it there, but is still writing for the National Post now and again, the Canadian newspaper, the conglomerate. So interesting, all of this thing coming out. Now, how many people do you have on this lawsuit, and is this pending, or is it going to be launched soon? Exactly.
It'll be quicker than people think, because two things have happened. First of all, Field McConnell, who's my colleague, we're not founders because everyone is equal in the Horse Cafe Citizens Association, but he was one of the earliest people on the American side of the border to represent what I thought I needed in the organization of Horse Cafe. Because as a fighter pilot or retired fighter pilot and a commercial pilot, isn't it interesting how few pilots have been interviewed about 911?
Exactly.
Like, when was the last time you heard a pilot interviewed about what could and what couldn't have happened on 911?
Not one spoke up. He was the first one that I heard on Coast to Coast that came forth.
Well, isn't it interesting, you see, because if you wanted to do an analysis of what could and what could not have happened on 911, surely the first group of people you should be talking to are the fighter pilots who would normally intercept these planes and the large passenger jet pilots who would know how they could be flown and they couldn't be flown. For example, if you talk to a pilot and ask them, could they or anyone they know have flown a plane across the Pentagon lawn, 10 feet elevation at 540 miles an hour, they'll tell you no, because the turbulence would normally pull you into the lawn.
Now, what's the other question I was going to ask? What was the reason Building 7 came down, was pulled? Larry Silverstein had it pulled.
No, he didn't. People who had that building, the people who had it pulled were the people who owned the mortgage on the building. And the mortgage was was owned up to October 2000 by the world's largest private pension fund, which is the TIAA CREF, the Teachers Insurance Annuity Association College Retirement Equity Fund. And this is the fund that handles the retirement benefits of faculty, about 3 million people across America, and includes the University of Cairo, American University of Cairo, and Beirut. And these people, through their pension fund, own the mortgage of around $460 million on the building number 7 up to October 2000. In October 2000, the mortgage was sold with the stream of revenue that comes in interest and rent from the buildings of the tenants to a private equity group called Blackstone. And between October 2000 and 9/11, that mortgage was insured, and it was a $430 million mortgage. It was insured, Ladybug, for $860 million. Right, so when it was demolished, it wasn't demolished by Larry Silverstein, it was demolished by the owners of the mortgage, a private equity group, in which I believe Saddam Hussein's family and the Osama bin Laden's family and the Carlyle group had an interest. And when it was demolished, they had a $430 million mortgage that was suddenly covered by an $860 million insurance policy. And the profits were shared amongst senior faculty across Canada and the United States. Blood and hush money.
This is the way that they divvy up the world pie. But it's all this insurance fraud thought out years in advance, by the looks of it. How long?
Yes, and there's a piece of software that actually there's a piece of software that facilitates insurance fraud, and it's called Mindbox software. And very interesting, Mindbox software, it's now, as of January of last year, but prior to that, it was in the custody of a British Columbia company called McDonald Detweiler & Associates. And what Mindbox software will do, it will take a loan, and it will continuously adjust the insurance policy around that loan in order to maximize the profit for the lender if the borrower goes bankrupt or the borrower dies or whatever. Now, the intriguing thing about McDonald Detweiler and Associates is it's owned by the British Columbia Investment Management Corporation and the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan and the Carlyle Group. And McDonald Detweiler also makes another piece of software that allows you to steer planes into buildings called Instrument Approach Procedure software. So on the morning of 9/11, McDonald Detweiler, and therefore the Carlyle Canada Ontario Teachers Pension Plan and the British Columbia Investment Management Corporation trustees and insiders, had real-time knowledge of the names of the passengers in the planes that were being hijacked through the Sabre reservation system. They had real-time knowledge of the position of the planes as they headed towards the targets, and they had real-time knowledge of the loan agreement on the target building and the insurance cover. And they used Mindbox software, which has a refresh rate every 15 seconds, to adjust the insurance on the people inside the plane and the crew and the pilots and the hull and the target buildings to maximize the return on investment to the lenders group, which I allege was the Carlyle Canada private equity group, to the lender group as they sponsored the red team during the 9/11 war games.
Now, in this lawsuit with the Carlyle group, who are going to be the ones that are given this the papers in the lawsuit? Are these the head people, the CEOs of these companies? How do you take that?
Oh yes, absolutely. But we're talking about two lawsuits here. The first lawsuit is the one filed by Captain Field McConnell after a lot of discussion with myself, that he's filed in the Fargo court about 3 weeks ago for loss of earnings as a result of his involuntary early retirement, because he and I both wrote to Boeing and he wrote to the Airline Pilots Association asking for assurance that the missile gyroscopes and the explosives that Boeing has admitted putting on the plane have been removed, because as a pilot, he cannot discharge his fiduciary obligations to his passengers and his crew, because he cannot get into a plane and guarantee a safe flight, because that plane can be taken and flown remotely into a building or through a mid-air detonation or ignition, turned into an incendiary, and the passengers vaporized. Now, he wrote on the 10th of December of last year to Boeing and NORAD and ALPA and warned them, and he and I had a lot of discussions prior to that, warned them that if these weapons were not removed from Boeing planes, then they could expect to see another incident rather like United 93, where the plane, the fuselage and the passengers were literally vaporized with ultra-high temperature incendiaries. So on the 1st of January of this year, KI-574, which is an Adam Air Boeing 737 in Indonesia, was, I believe, vaporized, possibly by the Chinese People's Liberation Army, using Boeing Iridium satellite communication systems, and the debris, no significant debris has been found. And that was took place over 6,000 feet of water, 2,000 meters. So it's a classic insurance scam by taking out large insurance on the crew and the hull and the passengers, etc. So fast forward, what Field McConnell did about 3 weeks ago, he demanded a guarantee from Boeing, the chairman of Boeing, James McNerney, that all the missile gyroscopes had been removed from the plane, for which Boeing paid the world's largest fine in corporate history of $615 million last year to the Department of Justice to drop its investigation into these, amongst others, illegal modification. And that assurance was not forthcoming from Boeing, so Field McConnell retired early, and he was compelled to do because he couldn't guarantee the safety of his crew, and he's filed a civil RICO, and that's a racketeering influence and corrupt organization lawsuit in Fargo in North Dakota against Boeing and ALPA for three times his estimated loss of earnings, which is three times $1.5 million, which he can do under a RICO suit. And that is working through the courts. Now, at any time, we can use the progress we make with that relatively smaller suit, although $4.5 million is not a negligible amount, and on behalf of all the people who died and their relatives and descendants, and basically this was an attack on the American Republic, it was an attempt to decapitate the regime, and file a civil RICO suit for the wrongful deaths associated with what I would describe as a murder for hire network that dates back to the 70s and the Arkansas prison system, and we call those crimes Arkanside for obvious reasons, and you can Google for the term Arkanside, and the loss of property associated with the insurance and securities frauds of 911. So we're working on that document now. It's about 100 pages long. We've got a provisional list of 100 defendants. The first three are Al Gore, Maurice Strong, and John Deutsch. I've got another 97 prospective defendants that I don't want to share with you at this stage, because I'm working with the Citizens Association of Forensic Economists, because what we're looking for is what's called proximity. We only want people who are really close either to the weapon and the opportunity and the motive that would allow them or support the idea that they could be part of a conspiracy to attack America on 911. And that's a continuous, it's a very hard process to drop some people off that list and keep others on as we find research. But I would estimate that by the end of April, possibly May at the latest, we will have a civil RICO suit, rather like the family of Nicole Simpson brought against OJ and won, for Arkanside, wrongful deaths associated with Arkanside and the property losses associated with Kyoto 911, for three times the estimated losses, which are $1.5 trillion times three is $4.5 trillion.
Now, the plaintiffs, who are the plaintiffs in this matter?
They will be, I don't know if recruited is the right word, but what we're asking our Horse Cafe Yahoo group, and as I've said, we've got 670, is to take a look at this draft lawsuit, which is, at the moment, it's circulating amongst an internal group of about three or four people. When it's relatively stable, and I hope that'll be by the end of next week, we'll share it with the Yahoo group and the website, for that matter. And then we'll invite people to help us develop the or refine the arguments or bios with each of the named defendants. And we'll look at the people who write in and try and select those who have expert knowledge, either eyewitnesses of these attacks or expert knowledge of the relative criminality, if you will. I mean, some of these people, like Webster Hubble, the partner of Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm, was sent to jail for 21 months for fraudulently billing partners and clients at the Rose Law Firm. So what we're really looking for is people who we don't have to prove that they're criminals because they've already been convicted. And actually, within this group of 100 people, there's plenty of people who have been convicted.
Already, like the Rizzuto clan and the Bonanno clan. Now, how do you get these other corporations, Enron already, and Hollinger and these companies, they're right on the hotline right now, but Enron's gone through the court system. So this is the way that you've already gained the knowledge that these companies were part and parcel of this diabolical mass murder scam, and they probably were plotting some more inside jobs. Is that this whole scenario, what they've drawn up?
Well, we have to be very careful. You see, people, unless they've been in a large corporation, they don't differentiate. When one says Enron had 100,000 employees, and it had people who washed the floors and put the debris away from the offices, and then employees, and then middle-level managements, and then directors. And traditionally, when I grew up in industry, one said that the directors represented the shareholders, and their sole responsibility was to maximize shareholder value. Now, tragically, what's happened and has actually helped in the process of destroying American industry and government is people like Maurice Strong realized that one way of hijacking a company like Enron that had some excellent products and excellent services was to lend its directors money through what are called off-book partnerships and actually encourage the directors to destroy their own companies. So if you look at Enron, what happened is a number of directors probably took some off-book loans from these private equity groups and then bet against their own company by shorting the shares. And if you look at a classic example, and people don't really understand it, Nortel was the biggest pump and dump scam in North America. It's twice as big as Enron. The shares went up to $120, and then came down to three. What most people don't understand, that the chairman of Nortel until April of 2001 was Frank Carlucci, who's with the Carlyle Canada private equity group. And then in April of 2001, it became Linton Wilson, the Canadian, but it was Nortel's voice internet protocol inside the Pentagon that was used by the conspirators as a virtual private network inside the Pentagon communication system to trick the Pentagon into standing down on 911. So these companies were actually corrupted and sabotaged from the inside. And lots of good people, both investors and employees in these companies, lost their jobs because they were targets for organized crime.
Boy, so this is something now that you figure might all transpire as a lawsuit in the courts by the end of May at least.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't want to be hostage to fortune. It's a very complex case, you see. But then again, interestingly enough, it may not be as complicated as one might think, because going back to, and people visiting hawkscafe.com can see it on the website, we think that there is a universal remedy for the citizen for dealing with murder by state-sponsored terrorism or a government, and that is, at least in the United States, you have, under the Ninth Amendment of the American Constitution, it states that a enumerated right in the American Constitution is not intended to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. So Field McConnell is American, and I'm Canadian, and I'm a British citizen as well. What we think is that every citizen in the world, not just American and Canadian and British or Australian, including Saudi Arabia and India and the Chinese citizen, they have the right to collect evidence against people suspected of the wrongful death of a fellow citizen. And that works both ways. So, for example, if I die in suspicious circumstances and it was possible for you to investigate my death, I would expect you to do it. That is, and if you died in suspicious circumstances, this is what I'm doing with Horse Cafe, it's up to me, as my duty and obligation to any citizen, to collect evidence against the people suspected of their wrongful death, which is very different from accusing those suspects of murder. But it does allow you, under American law, and my plan is that we extend RICO, Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization remedies globally through the United Nations, which incidentally I believe should be disbanded as a corrupt and dysfunctional organization. What I believe is that we will, by perhaps the end of May, or what I would hope is that Horse Cafe has 10,000 members. And we have then the ability to collect evidence from eyewitnesses or people who know these people that actually would support a civil lawsuit in the courts for damages associated with wrongful death. And funnily enough, Ladybug, that's not very complicated, because we can have a jury give us a victory in the case of a claim for wrongful death, whether the jury thinks that the defendants were negligent, reckless, willful, or fraudulent. You don't have to prove what is known as mens rea, a guilty mind. The defendants may not have intended to kill someone. It might have just been collateral. They intended to knock the building down, and it just so happened certain people were in it.
So you can't really prove that they didn't want to chase them out in the first place. Some of these companies were notified not to show up on 9/11.
Yes, and that will emerge, because what you get with a civil RICO lawsuit in a court is you get what's called discovery. So you can get these people to produce evidence that would allow them to prove they weren't negligent, reckless, willful, or fraudulent in causing the wrongful death, in which case the jury would find that they are they're not responsible for that claim. However, the body of evidence we've got now in terms of the weapons and the opportunity and the motive, including insurance fraud and property fraud, I think is overwhelming. I think we will very, very easily win this class action lawsuit against these people and their sponsors, which include the world's largest bankers, JP Morgan, BNP Paribas, Group AXA, Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and so on.
So the plaintiffs don't have to be just the victims in this 9/11, or do they? Who?
No, they don't. They have to be people who, of the 670 members, and hopefully 10,000 members at the end of May, can demonstrate that they're capable, and this is very important, of acting pro se. That is, they can stand up in court and they can put questions either to the defendants or the lawyers representing the defendants. But on the Horse Cafe side, we don't want lawyers representing us as plaintiffs.
I see. So each person who will be a plaintiff could act as a lawyer themselves then?
Yes, it's called technically in American law, and I don't know if that has the same term in Canada, acting pro se, which is a Latin term meaning for themselves.
For themselves. Well, this is very, very intriguing. I want to continue this to another day, if we could.
Sure.
This is fascinating. I see the pattern. I wanted to get in the next discussion that we'll get into is the put options, the short selling of them. So this is why part and parcel of the this class action you've named.
Yes, absolutely. They were long in New York and short in Chicago.
Yes, this is what I want to get into. This is very, very intriguing. So if we're going to come to an end, because usually our show goes on 1 hour, but we've gone a bit over, and we'll continue this at another date. And we'll
1 minute remaining.
Now, we want to thank our guest very kindly for coming on the show. We had on a very special guest. I thank you, David Hawkins.
So, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. The calling card is ending so that you know.
All right.
I'll call right back with another one, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much, and Eric, yes, and talk to you later. Yeah. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.